So we're reading about the four foundations of mindfulness, and this is essentially what we're doing. This is essentially what we're doing with our meditation practice, both on the cushion and then as we move into our daily life. Into where the recollection chapter sort of comes in. These are methods of cutting our fixation on ourselves as solid, as something that needs to be constantly curated or defended or protected. And the ways we tend to do that protection, cultivation, is by aggression, or running away from something, or as Chicken Pimper writes, warfare, confusion, passion, and aggression. Those are the activities that support the ego, the ego's kingdom. So through meditation practice, we are sort of essentially doing one remarkable thing. We're actually sitting in one on our bottoms, doing one thing, paying slight attention to the outgoing breath. Well, you could say it's more than one thing. We're also watching thoughts arise. And we're recognizing them as thoughts and releasing them. So there's this kind of beautiful simplicity to it. Because no matter what we think we're doing, that's what we're doing. And I'm telling you, myself, sitting on these, I have been doing a lot in the last hour. I've been planning, I've been trying not to plan, I've been watching myself be cold, be hot, be uncomfortable. So this sort of huge array of activity arises, mental activity arises, to remove us from this one thing that we're doing, which is sitting on the cushion. And the Chicken Pimper talks about, I'm going to go a little bit over the first few foundations if you'd like, that would be helpful. He talks about that we actually start, that we're working with our breath and our body, the mindfulness of body, we're sitting, but we're actually working with our mostly in our leisure, carrying around a psychosomatic body. Not even our real form, it's the idea of ourselves. It's our concept of how we look, how we feel, how dissatisfied we are, how irritated, how uncomfortable, how things feel uncomfortable. Are we actually present physically? And it takes a while of sitting on the cushion when you realize that it takes you a while to actually get here. I don't know, is that the common experience with
it?
Yeah. So we're developing a sense of solidness, that gravity actually works, that we're actually just sitting here, we're not, we recognize when we're traveling to other cities or doing other activities. And so with these techniques of breath, observing our breath, of recognizing thoughts as they arise, and letting them go, we are actually slowly settling into just being here, just being here. It's so simple, and yet
remarkable. We're getting this nose.
It's not, but it is. I mean, if you think about it.
There's an AA slogan, it's simple, but it's not easy. I think that's relevant here.
Right. So, slowly after we settle, we develop a more expansive self. And so that's mindfulness of body. Mindfulness of life is interesting. Survival. The instinct to live can be seen as containing awareness, meditation, and mindfulness. It constantly tunes us into what's happening. So the life force which keeps us alive itself becomes the practice of mindfulness. And what this relates to is this sort of sense that we're constantly protecting our aliveness. We're paranoid that something is going to threaten us. And when we're on the meditation cushion, we grasp onto states. You know, we might have a state of clarity, a moment of clarity, and we hold on to that for dear life. We experience that. And the instruction is to let that go. It's another concept. It's another experience. It's momentarily tangible, but it's dissolving at the same time. So we're observing that. We're letting go of awareness just as we're contacting it over and over and over again. Touch and go, which we'll get into further a bit later. You can't grasp onto the meditative state. You can't hold on to it or cherish it. What that tends to do is actually lead to regression and kind of a tightness. Creates a kind of further the storyline that you're telling yourself about who you are and about what your experience is. And the nature of the meditation experience, actually the nature of experience itself, is that we can hold on to nothing. It's always arriving and disappearing. And we're always commenting. There's been a lot of commentary about it. And as soon as something occurs, we're telling ourselves a story about it, as though we're going to deliver the story of me to the person next to us, or we're going to go home and say, this happened during my meditation. And let go. The instruction is, be ferocious. Don't be nasty to yourself. Don't be heavy-handed. But be fundamentally brave. And guess that you can't hold on to a storyline, either during your practice or afterwards. Guys, if you have any questions or any objections, please. What we're not doing is we're not creating yet another aspect of ourselves to solidify. Even if we're actually arriving in the present moment over and over and over again. So the expression is to have that you need confidence, you develop a sense of confidence that you don't have to secure your own mind. You don't have to pin it down. So mindfulness of life relates to this clinging tendency. not only in connection with the meditative state, but more importantly in connection with the level of raw anxiety about survival that manifests in us constantly, second by second. Our connection to this life is our breath. We have confidence that as long as we're alive, that's what we'll be doing. And we can use that simple connection as a kind of affirmation, so we don't need to tell our story over and over again. So mindfulness of effort way of calling it, saying that is exertion. In this book, we're talking about that as life force.
Spontaneous.
I'm sorry, we're just talking about life force. Spontaneous discipline. And that has to do with bringing ourselves back to our meditation technique over and over again. It's not heavy-handed. We're not killing our thoughts. But it brings us out of our dream world. And coming back to our breath brings us out of our dream world and back to ourselves sitting on the cushion. And it occurs with a sort of sudden flash of awareness. It isn't like, we've talked about this earlier in the class, it isn't like you go over to the switch and turn on the switch and go, now I'm back to my breath. This leap happens because of your fundamental, I guess there's a sense of exertion just sitting properly. There's a kind of invitation that gets issued, you're issuing to yourself. And you've set up all the circumstances by the discipline that you're relating to again and again to come back to the present moment again and again. So you've already invested a lot of energy into returning to this moment. So that the exertion is a funny kind of word because it's not heavy-handed. But you've created the environment for it to occur already. So it happens as a kind of sudden leap. It's described as that you come back and you recognize that something's happening. It doesn't have a name. It's just you're brought back. So you're brought back abruptly, immediately, without a name. And without any context, you're just back. And of course, you may hear yourself going, I'm back. I wasn't meditating, but now I am gone.
Try again.
Yeah.
I actually recently had that experience of being able to identify quickly when I was going off. Coming back, and then I realized after a while, I was like, my God, this is boring.
Yay!
Yay!
Yay! Well done! It's terribly boring. It's really, I don't know.
Your mind can't go off and wander for very long, and you realize, this is just, wow.
This is amazing.
Nothing going on here.
Like, the mind, we're such in the habit of wanting entertainment.
Yeah.
Of wanting to do anything but just be with ourselves. It's exhausting. So, but this is actually what we're doing. We're training ourselves to be bored.
Yeah.
And to be okay with that. I mean, it's much more exciting, all the screwed up mental states and all the stories you're telling or all the anger that you can bring up or all the planning in the future. That's really entertaining. But that's not what we're doing here. There's time in your life for that. But this train that you've trapped yourself during meditation, you've got this amazing opportunity to be bored. and to actually watch the patterns of your thoughts that come up. Recognize them, let them go. I see there's a phrase called cool boredom. Has that been brought up?
Yeah. It infiltrates the rest of your life too.
Well, that's exactly where the next
driving or something like that. Look, my mind's wandering. I'm becoming much more aware of my mind going off into, you know, la la land. Anxiety land.
You can't really do that when you're crying.
Yeah,
I mean, more dangerous anyway.
I was shopping last night, and I sort of noticed, like, oh, here's what I think about when I'm walking around the store. It's very boring. I like to buy the same 10 things at Amazon every time, and I know where they are. I'm not looking. And I'm like, oh, I'm noticing these people and what I think about them. Oh, how does that relate to how I feel about myself? Why is that the thing I want to comment to myself about?
Isn't that interesting?
I almost started crying because I felt so bad and recognized. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's from meditation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, because I like totally noticed. Like, I think it was sort of like this thought back here and it came forward and I heard exactly what, you know, you're looking at people and this is why you're picking those people and this is what you're noticing about them.
And commenting and to yourself.
Yeah.
Like well, comparing the whole thing.
And I thought, oh, yeah.
There's a judgment. I hear that to myself, like, oh, that's a judgment.
Well, not even judgment. It's like, that's what I care about myself.
I don't know if it's quite on topic, but something I've been wondering about is sort of the meditation instruction to sort of be, you know, present and aware of the sounds. And I often feel that I become hypersensitized, and I'm wondering if that's, is that another sort of, entertaining myself? Where, you know, it almost felt like small sounds were like thuds that I was hearing. You know, little sounds were becoming huge footsteps in my mind. And I don't think I was spending too much time, I don't think I was telling myself a story about this, but I just had this feeling of, you know, too many sounds. And what are your thoughts?
Are you talking about this during meditation itself, or just in
during meditation itself? Yeah, sort of hyper.
Well, just think about it. You're not doing anything. What are you doing? You're sitting there. So sounds that might have just been on the periphery of your awareness are knocking you on the head.
Mm-hmm.
So you're actually, you know, but it's also transient. It doesn't mean anything. It's not a big deal. Right?
Okay,
what are you going to mean? Right?
Right, so I guess it's sort of, so it's not just another, started to think, is this a story I'm telling myself to keep myself entertained? But it is, you know, it didn't have that quality, but I sort of wanted
the magnification.
My
colleague and I do a guided meditation before we have a once-week meeting. And she's first had to sort of focus on your body for a minute, and then just notice the sounds that come and they go. We sit in our office, we sit in the lot, and there's noises we hear only during that time.
Wow.
A little noise. It's very regular, and it's very quiet, and when we're sitting talking and everything, and we're like, the noise is there, and then we start talking to it, and now it's gone.
Right. But I do think there's something interesting about that, though, which is that there is this kind of sense of once you get out of your own way, the world starts opening up to you, in a sense. Once your big agenda of me isn't sort of being a big blockade, you know, like a banner you're carrying in front of you, either with all any of your senses, things do kind of have a brighter aspect, which again, you don't hold on to. I mean, that's kind of the message over and over again, is that we're not adding up our great accomplishments or awarenesses, even as insights arise, we're not adding them up. In particular, when you're on the cushion, you're doing your you're doing the technique to disengage from your, to have a kind of sense of observation and disengagement from grasping.
And constant commentary.
Constant commentary.
And I think, may I say something?
Please.
So, I think when, I think the point, like when I mentioned in reading, you know, about the sound, was because you were all hearing the sound
yeah.
at that point. So, that, the point is we're not trying to create a perfect world. That we are sitting in this perfect room and the perfect temperature and there's no sound, no babies crying, and you know, no irritated husbands or whatever. You're just, so we're not trying to get rid of anything. And that's why there's a sense of just sort of open to what's there, as well as open to your thought process coming and going, and lack and just dropping the judgment. I'm not doing it right. I'm always wandering. Now I'm so irritated. It's cold. I'm this. So you're just letting go of all of that, because that is just the story. That's just the entertainment that we crank up. Because, as you said, it's very boring, and we're avoiding all the time being right on that stop.
But none of that's a problem either.
No.
All this BS that's coming and going is simply not a problem. So actually, the flavor of your experience in that moment, you know, okay. So, I took a note here. I've been reading a couple of different things, including our text, which is overwhelming. Every sentence is just, we could have a whole class on every sentence. But, this practice triggers the awareness of the present moment, which includes boredom. There's nothing to run away from, and no need to be derailed by our entertainment. So we watch our desire for entertainment come up. We kind of get hooked to a little thing. We go, oh, and go back to the technique. No problem. You weren't a bad person for following it. You weren't, and you're not a brilliant meditator for returning to the technique. So we're off to the fourth mindfulness. And I love that this one is called touching the surface of the mind. It has a real, it's almost a visual, beautiful visual expression of what we're doing, because there's a gentleness in that. And, mind functions, our focus functions on one thing at a time, the direct movement of the mind. So we're touching the surface of the mind by observing directly one instant at a time. Sound. I'm hearing the sound. That's one instant. I'm cold. That's one instant. Why did I wear this? It's really uncomfortable. One instant. And then it's gone. And thoughts and emotions which arise will come in the form of memories. habitual patterns of thought and fantasies. Let's see. I'll read some from the text here. I'm on page 92 at the top. In the sitting practice of meditation, thoughts and emotions come in the forms of memories, habitual thought patterns, fantasies, and expectations of the future. This experiential aspect of our minds is quite provocative and entertaining, and it's an easy source for preoccupation. You can spend a lot of time, you can get through a lot of meditation thinking about what you should have said and where you should, what you should have done and where you're going. And then develop the thing, and that was good. It was a good meditation. The intuitive aspect, or the clarity, is refreshing and provides relief from the torrent of thoughts and emotions. The emotional reference points in our minds change from one topic to another, and they also alternate with the sense of relief. We experience the gears shifting from one mood to another. Occasional clarity occurs between one mood or fantasy and the next. But we don't attach. We're not. We recognize that clarity. We're gone. We're back to the present. We ask ourselves whether we should pull back from those preoccupations and try to be a good boy or girl, clean and pure. However, sometimes our boredom suggests to us that we might enjoy these little entertainments. So, and we feel hypnotized by them, and we indulge in them. So we don't need to. We can watch that occur. We can let go of it. And we can watch it occur again. Let go of it again. But meanwhile, we're actually training our mind to not be, to be flexible and to be fluid and to observe ourselves, our own patterns of, to sort of get to know ourselves. It's described as a process of intelligent alertness. An aroused intelligence, light-handed intelligence. So that struck me, actually, reading this, as a kind of real generosity, that we have a kind of intelligence to observe what's happening and go back to our technique. Without mind and its conflicts, we could not, as a meditator, we couldn't develop balance. So conflicts that are regarded as the same things that arise in the mind are necessary parts of the practice of meditation. They're not the enemy. And we don't kill them. We just let them arise and disappear. So this balance is the state of wakefulness and mindfulness. And that's the discipline. Did anybody get delighted by the description of where it's like stroking a kitty cat? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I thought you would like that because you promised
that. I like them. I'm just allergic to them and they could kill me. That's all. I have nothing against them.
Okay.
It happened until I was sick.
Oh.
And then he discovered that I shouldn't be around. Yeah.
So there, a little bit past that section, there were a couple of lines I underlined. They're talking about how the light touch is actually harder to do than the hard touch, you know, the grasping. I'll just read a couple of sentences. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where is that?
It's a couple pages from the end of the chapter.
It's a light touch,
yeah.
Rather than hard work. It's rather than hard work.
So, yeah.
Page 95.
Okay. This approach from one point of view is not at all demanding. It's a light touch rather than hard work. From another point of view, it is extremely demanding. If you put all of your effort and energy into something, it occupies your mind, which makes you feel better. However, if your mindfulness practice is touching and experiencing everything without being heavy-handed, you feel suspended in the middle of nowhere.
Like, what are you doing? What really are you doing? It's not... Because the mind constantly wants to grasp onto something that's doing something really valuable and really important, and if it isn't something that you did, you know, that you can take to the bank, then what are you doing?
Yeah, I think it was interesting to me that it's sort of articulating that the light touch is actually hard, a more, you know, it's less natural for human beings to do that than to just grab onto something.
Yeah.
Anyway. It is.
Because one of the challenges I feel is if I'm going for light touch, am I actually trying to avoid it? You know, so sometimes I feel I get confused between whether or not I'm just doing a light touch and go, or if it's like, okay, yeah, that's it. Let's go do something else and go back to the breath because I don't want to touch it. You know what I'm saying?
You mean if a thought comes up,
Or particularly an emotion, something comes up, and so like says it'd be great to be a light touch, but then I feel like, did I really look at that? Did I really acknowledge that, or did I just try to? And then of course I'm the watcher, so I get the whole ego thing coming back in. So it's like.
So what, basically? It's okay, either, I mean, even that's included in the process, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even your, did I do this right, or didn't I do this right?
Yeah.
Or did, right, that's also included.
Mm-hmm.
No problem.
Mm-hmm. And no one right way. So sometimes maybe it's just the intention to just follow the most simple technique, no matter what's going on, and you just work with that. And other times, it's maybe appropriate to lean into the emotion a little more and to just be with it and really not just quickly move from it. So again, you know, it's not like, okay, there's this one thing we do and that's it, and you grab onto that and hold it all the whole time. But you can, without confusion, just work with it one way or the other.
Can I just say, sure. This is your practice and your life, and there's no Sayosak Machina going to come down and point a finger and tell you you're doing it right or wrong, but there's an internal sense of wisdom, your own internal wisdom is showing you how to, you can actually have confidence in your approach at that moment. But I just want to also say that if I have a big emotional upheaval, I'm sometimes barely able to return to the technique, or it takes me much longer to return to the technique, because it's sitting there on my chest. It's like, and just kind of holding the posture allows for a shift to occur sometimes. But does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's just very interesting what you said, because I have moments where I have very strong emotion which I couldn't tell you the name for.
Yeah.
And what I usually wind up doing is sort of noticing it for a breath and then reading it out, but it's not. I was noticing, I'm thinking, I don't think touch means like drop, but that's kind of what I wind up doing, because that's what it feels like needs to happen. I thought, oh, I'm not doing it right, because that's not really touch, but I guess touch could be, you know, could be this, or it could be sort of a grab and let go.
It's whatever's occurring in the moment with your fundamentally trustworthy. You're trustworthy enough to know when you're getting far away, or when you're sort of you're returning to your practice, and there's no you're not going to be hauled off to jail. However, it's serves. The meditation police, right? I mean, we're getting to know ourselves, right? We're getting to know our own past.
And gentleness, remembering gentleness is so important.
So you're not beating yourself over the head with it. You're not a mallet and whack yourself over.
And not solidifying anything.
Yeah.
It's emotion. It's this thought with a lot of paint. Colored.
We do tend to solidify these our golden moments and then all our shit. It's like we live suspended between these two concepts of ourselves, isn't it? Yeah, right? And we're really hard on ourselves. So we have to be gentle. Mm-hmm.
Which is the non-aggression.
Right.
Right. Well, and the other thing, when you think about it, too, if you're aggressive about it, because throughout life you've been doing stuff to, you know, like beating yourself up, it's like, well, you know, this is an opportunity to be gentle with myself and not keep on doing what I've been doing all the time.
You're exactly right. You're actually training your mind to stop doing what you've been doing all the time. Even more than just for the few minutes I'm going to do this, you're actually, it's almost like you're putting money in the bank of sanity.
Mm.
Every time you do this.
Wow.
I'll have some of that.
Really? What else are we doing this for, right?
Right.
We're recognizing insanity, and insanity is not being in our body, in this place, where we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's astonishing if you think about it, how that we have to actually train ourselves to be completely here.
Mm-hmm.
So the next chapter is recollection, which is essentially a sort of a sense of awareness when we're off the cushion of the kind of mental awakeness that we've been practicing on the cushion. And throughout our days, as we go about the activities of our day, we recognize awake. We are in the middle of our day and we sort of have our own sort of glimpse of awakeness as we're going. Is awakeness even a word?
It's
can we accept it as a word?
Thank you. Awareness.
During our sort of off the cushion experience, we're remembering to be aware, and it's not self-conscious. It isn't that we're capturing our awareness and carrying it around with us everywhere. It isn't like hyper mindfulness. We come to kind of alertness. We recognize it. And then we continue, we drop it, we can't hold on to it, and then we continue throughout our day. And there was something in here, I think it was in here, that we sometimes forget whether we're on the cushion or we're off the cushion. Like, is this, because frankly, what we're training ourselves to do on the cushion is to be awake off the cushion. Mm-hmm. That's all. That's the point of meditation, isn't it? So you can go be sane when you're not having to deal with anybody. Mm-hmm. That's a lot easier, right? So it's sort of getting out in the world and watching how your mind functions. When you're sort of brought to awareness of your own pattern and of the space around you and of the energy around you, and there's a kind of shift that happens and you can't hold on to it, but then you keep going and then boop, it will occur again and again, hopefully with more and more frequency. Although it does seem that you have to be careful, because there are times when you are you're always with yourself, actually. So you're always in a sense, you're always meditating.
You said when you talked about our ability to help other people is largely based on our ability to sabotage the self-centered background of our own mind.
Right.
To the development of mindfulness and awareness. And this week I have one of the students I'm working with is in just a horrible personal situation. And he's trying to do something except making a noise, which is normally for me like I often do. I say, look, I've been stressing a lot. He's sort of making man's noises. That's like one of my triggers. And so normally I would have sort of given him the, like, you know, cut the shit out, your ear thing. And in this situation, I've been thrown out of the house by his natural mother. Mm-hmm. And so there's something in me, I mean, because I paused myself and I didn't really think about it. I just walked over and said, how are you making that noise? That's kind of an interesting noise.
Really?
Can you show me? Can I try to make the noise?
Wow.
Have you ever made, where did you learn? Did you figure it? Like, having a call conversation, which is not, like, totally not my first reaction. My first reaction is cut it out. How's anybody supposed to work? And after that, like, I didn't know it's after they've been thrown out of the house, but I just had the sense he just needed, like, an adult to connect to him and be fine. And I was like, oh, okay. And I'm not very good at making noise. He was much better than it. But it's sort of that funny, like, it pulled me out of my, you know, my job is to make him be quiet.
Right. Really extraordinary. And you're exactly right. That this allegiance to ourselves, this whole building our shit together and protecting ourselves, and like, this is my scene and I need these boundaries, the allegiance shifts to where the space opens up and you start to see that you're sharing this space. There's a lot of other folks who are suffering, and you kind of open up, so your allegiance starts shifting to wanting to relate. You don't even, it wasn't even like you wanted to, you just did. You know what I mean? It was always,
yeah,
almost,
yeah, like,
you weren't being Nurse Nancy, as they say, right?
Well, after, I mean, it was after the fact, I mean, I think I just sort of realized it wasn't, that I couldn't yell at him. Like, I knew he was in this tough spot, and what he didn't need is one more woman yelling at him. So I was, oh, I mean, what the heck? He's not going to work either way.
That initial mindfulness that, you know, we're taught here has allowed me in a very similar way to get over myself, and what you end up seeing is everything comes to an agreement if you could just get past, and I thought that was a beautiful example. You can get, come to an agreement when you can get past the own grasping, self-absorbed thought.
Comes to an agreement. That's an interesting phrase. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, it goes in line with what you were just saying.
Yeah.
We're all,
yeah.
You know, you see everybody is suffering. Everybody has, you know, their special circumstance. But it's most of the time we're so busy in our own special circumstance.
Right.
I like Elisa's example. You said afterwards you realized know you need more water, Bomanyalia. But in the moment, you weren't thinking about that. You were just open, and you weren't defended, and you probably unconsciously just perceived as what the kid needed. So you did.
And he may have actually done it because he thought, well, that's how I please get a cancer replacement.
Yeah.
Yell at me about it.
Yeah.
And I think the little guilty. How do you do that? And he goes, oh, like this. I'm like, oh, okay.
So that's how we can shift things.
And the other thing is that, like, it's not like you're diffusing the situation, but you are diffusing the situation by, instead of like, that is annoying, what you did was so annoying, please stop that. And, you know, so yeah, that's pretty interesting, just being, you know, I guess by doing the practice and meditation, you know, being comfortable with myself, that helps, you know, that helps me be comfortable with other people. You know, it's challenging at times, but, you know, I think that's what it does, because we're all interconnected anyways, and that, you know, that it's easy sometimes just to shift blame or something that's going on with you and reflect on the other person. I remember earlier you were saying about like having kind of almost like having a mirror in front of yourself, because we always see stuff that irritates. I mean, I know for myself, stuff that irritates me about other people and stuff that irritates me about myself. So it's good stuff.
In hospice, there's a lot of storytelling that happens to help people understand different ways of reaching people who are dying. And there was one really good story that was shared where there was an elderly gentleman who was pretty much shut down. He wasn't communicating at all with anybody. And the hospice worker went in and brought Play-Doh, was just playing around with the Play-Doh. And on a lark, just did a flat little surface circle and then put a smile face and then put it in front of him. And he just reached out and turned the smile upside down. And but the key thing is that was the first form of communication he had had for months. And so he actually had a breakthrough and he was able to get some small degree of communication exchange through using Play-Doh with this guy. But he was just he had been trying everything to try to reach him, and just this one thing happened to break through to him. So I just thought it was interesting. You're talking about sometimes you have that moment where you are connecting, you can connect with somebody. But there are a lot of those kind of stories in hospice about trying to have that breakthrough moment where somebody, you can be with them on their level. That's really interesting, because I would imagine you have to work with your own ambition to want to fix things,
right?
To want to have a result, and because that's a problem.
But the only way to have the breakthrough moment is to not want to have the breakthrough moment, right? You have to have a workshop on how about people talking about doctors being generally too much more to fix things, so that the hospice people need to just are more able to be there.
That's
it. Like that.
The common thread that I'm hearing also too is on when you kind of release what we're holding on to, what comes out is the solution in itself. And that's what I meant by the agreement.
Yeah.
When you release what we have.
Well, what we're actually presented with is what's actually there. And in that space, anything is possible. There's a whole universe of possibilities besides what our agenda is. And you don't see that if you're leading with your, whatever it is that you're promoting about yourself. And the thing about recollection is that it occurs constantly throughout your day. It's it enables you to, throughout your life, cut your own sort of karmic seeds, your own habitual ways of recreating your own suffering and the kind of waves that reverberate from that. So you don't trigger yourself, you don't trigger a reaction, and you sort of stop the chain reaction of confusion. Well, he describes it more in the text, that it creates a gap in our further solidifying ourselves, that it shortens the life of our fixation, it strengthens our allegiance to the natural gaps that occur in our own mind. And it's on the cushion that we are learning how to recognize it, and it's in our daily life that we start incorporating that into the way we relate to ourselves and each other. This, the phrase kept coming to me when I was looking at this material, that we stop living as though we're just about to be annihilated by our own minds and by the world. By cutting that our own panic, by seeing our own panic, by cutting it, and by recognizing some space, we are creating an opportunity for freshness to occur, for solutions that we might not have thought of to arise.
And I love this sentence on this page 101, the last paragraph. The recollection of awareness throughout our lives is the preparation for beginning to help others.
Right.
Just being that open, that openness. And actually the paragraph before that, Michael pointed this out to me tonight. If one is open to these glimpses and to the possibility that they might recur, they come much more frequently. The effort of the discipline here is not so much direct or deliberate effort, but rather that you are accommodating possibilities of recollection. This effort doesn't save you from the chaos of a given day. Mm-hmm. It is a much more long-term approach. To me, it's just, oh, and then there's another sentence in the other paragraph. Our ability to help other people is largely based on our own ability to sabotage the self-centered background of our own lives through the development of mindfulness and awareness.
Right.
You've been saying that, less me, you know, like being able to let go of our fixation on self. And then the availability.
And he talks about skillful action. That this, that by creating that space and altering the orientation from what am I going to get out of it, you see what's needed in the situation more clearly. And your touch, your technique is what's required. So it's not so heavy-handed.
But I think there's the very hard part is to try to just see what the other person's piece is. And it's really hard because, like for my students, I'm invested a little bit, but they're my students, they're not my child. But that's the piece that in some ways I have to let go of, like my job as their teacher is to do, and I have this idea in my head what my job is. And when I can let that go and just say, this is a person who needs something. What can I sense what they need? But it's so hard when it's your own child.
Yeah.
And
it's harder when it's your own child.
And I think
what I notice for myself now when I'm letting myself sort of acknowledge, like there are moments when I walk around, my son's such a jerk, and I should throw him out of the house, I should make him buy this from there. I had this list of like all these things I would want to yell at him about. But then I have to look at it and say, that's about my being really concerned and feeling like I haven't done the right thing. And I just want to change it all because I want to be able to say, I've done all the right things. And then I have to say, and that's not what I need to do. It's not about, it needs not to be about me. But there's that part of me that it is about me. My little self wants to have that story.
I don't feel it's about me. If anything, any possible outcome that doesn't involve me that is fine. I don't need to feel vindicated. I just don't see any way his life isn't going to be destroyed. Mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do with me.
Mm-hmm. You mean by
the
referral to the therapist or by the way it
moves? The referral to the therapist is a big step on that way, okay? Because it's telling him that the only way that no human being can be told you're depressed, you have a medical condition because you feel depressed and you can't talk about what's happening. It's not a medical condition, it's an appropriate condition.
There are some therapists that actually still understand that. I know it's become all medical. I don't want to give
antidepressants,
but there are people out there.
In a similar situation, though, this is very relevant to what we're talking about, because in a similar situation where you see something clearly, you know, in your own eyes, but you have an intent, that intent be a good intent, good or bad, I think it's still an intent, and this allows you to be there. And I had a very similar situation with my sister with antidepressants. I mean, a mirror story. And I was very much trying to tell her that this is a normal piece of what's going on. But I didn't realize that that was her path to take. And it was a form of aggression on my end. And only until, and actually it took 2 years, I remember the conversation we had, and I finally realized, she said, where is your compassion? And I did break down, and then I stopped telling her what she should do, and I just switched gears, and it was, again, it wasn't about me anymore. It was,
I don't want to tell him what he should do.
It's tough with the ones we love, because, I mean, we love everyone, but it's especially difficult because
adult children present tremendous challenge for parents, because they have their own path. And we can't protect them at a certain point. It's very humbling. Well,
thank you.
That happened.
She said it wasn't a therapy session.
Little did we know. Well, all right, y'all.
Thank you.
We're done.
Does anyone need a...